Hey everybody, Stephen here from The Truth About Dyslexia. In today's episode, we've got a follow-up episode with Guy and Suzanne Pope-Mail. They are absolutely awesome. And in this episode, we're going to cover a few things that are a bit different. How businesses can operate a bit differently with neurodiverse employees who are dyslexic or ADHD. How they started their entrepreneurial journey, creating a business using their dyslexic mindset. And we're going to touch on some really awesome stuff. Like, we dig into this thing called mental health and emotional safety. You know, you think about health and safety at work, you know, how does it actually apply to your mind? It's a really good conversation. If you're in business, if you've got a job, could be something that's going to add a lot of value to your life. And it's one of these episodes I'd love you to share with anyone who has some influence in business. It could help them see from a company that's doing it really well, how to operate your business in a neurodiverse world. So let's dive into it. Hey everybody, Stephen here from The Truth About Dyslexia, and we've got another interview with the absolutely awesome Guy and Suzanne Pope-Mail. How do I pronounce your last name? I still can't.
Did it just right, Pope-Mail.
Pope-Mail, fantastic. The love. Now they're away at the moment. So tell me again, you're in the Catlins, is it, in New Zealand?
We're in the Catlins, which is south of Dunedin. It's a very remote place. We look out on a large beach that you could mistake to be a Australian or Hawaiian style beach. But right beside the beach is ancient New Zealand native forest. So it's quite a unique place in the world, and certainly a lovely place just to step away from the day-to-days and carry on with what we do, but carry on with just a different vibe happening.
Oh, it's fantastic to get away. Like, I was in Stewart Island probably 4 weeks ago, and it is, you know, people would never imagine how beautiful that far south is, especially on a sunny day. Well, you just can't imagine it, right?
I think this area is probably quite similar to Stewart Island in actual fact, with the beach and the forest and the remoteness. It's probably quite similar, I would say.
Yeah, definitely.
And what a better location than to talk about your entrepreneurial journey over, and let me see if my memory is right, 38 years in the cookie time business. Is that about right, 38 years?
Yep, 38 years. I was 19. My brother was 21. And although we had both sort of explored some, you might say, youthful entrepreneurial ideas, because our background in terms of our family was quite entrepreneurial. Although my father was a doctor, he was also, he dabbled in property development and was always very encouraging of new ideas and entrepreneurial activity. But this was really the first foray into a mainstream business. And we were very, very lucky in many respects. We hit the jackpot with the original Cookie Time product. You know, it was a super large American style cookie, 85 grams. I'm not sure what the diameter would be, but a good 130 or 140 centimeters. It was super new and innovative, and something fresh for New Zealanders. But it did resemble something that was very familiar to them, which is a biscuit, of course. We were that one step towards innovation, but not so far as to be a disconnect for the mainstream population. And I think also one of the other reasons why I was an instant winner was because we bought it out in a glass cookie jar. And I think the idea of putting your hand in the cookie jar, whether you're American or wherever you are in the world, sits there in our collective psychology. And so I think that we also, connecting the cookie with the cookie jar, it was slightly different. All of those things combined, of course, it was chocolate chip, and it had very, very large chunks of chocolate.
I was going to say it was chocolate chunk.
Yeah.
I can remember, I was just teaching at the time, and my colleague and I, we knew the day that the cookies were delivered to the cookie jar. So we used to go, morning tea was always around to the local shop around the corner from where we were teaching to get one of the fresh Cookie Time cookies, because they were absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah, Suzanne and I met actually after we launched the business. So her story of of how she connected with the brand was completely independent to what my brother Michael and I were doing at the time. But her story resembles the incredible instant success. In fact, we went out to 70 dairies, which are like milk bars or convenience stores, like 7-Eleven, slightly bigger maybe, but the New Zealand version. And we went out to 70 dairies in Christchurch on day one. And literally the jars were put out there full of cookies. There were about 40 cookies in a cookie jar. And we came back and waited for the phone to ring or not in a day or three. And by the end of the first day, we had the phone ringing saying that all the cookies had been eaten. And so it was one of those home runs from the get-go. And that was critically important for a 19-year-old and a 21-year-old, because at 19 and 21, you are going to make every mistake in the book because you haven't read the book, you haven't written the book, you don't even know that a book exists. And so we were able to ride the success of a super popular home run style product and make the mistakes that were going to be inevitable as the business grew up in terms of volume and scale. And because we started with a rented bakery, I mean, there was we didn't have any money. In fact, we had $3,000 in a minivan, and $3,000 wasn't enough to buy a bakery or set up a retail store. It was really not enough for terribly much at all. And so we approached a number of existing bakeries and pitched them the idea of using their bakery at nighttime and renting it from them on an hourly basis. And the vast majority of people that we approached laughed at us and said, you know, no, that's not definitely not going to be happening. But one final knock on the door said yes. And so we had access to a bakery in the evening for, you know, $20 an hour or whatever it might have been at the time. And then we were able to employ people. And basically that's how we started. So the whole thing was started with no money. And but thank goodness it was a great idea.
And I must say, like, I love that. And the reason we're telling this story on the podcast is I think so many dyslexics, people with ADHD, so many of us become entrepreneurs. And it's because we see these little gaps. And what I heard from you there, which is really important to take away, Guy, is that you picked something from a different market and brought it into the New Zealand market, which is a much smaller one, but it was tried and true in a different location. And you brought it over, you Kiwi-ized it a bit, but you also created a bit of an experience around it. You know, the hand in the cookie jar, you know, you played a bit of an environmental thing, which made you stand out from the rest. And I think that's important for anyone who's looking to get into business, right? That, you know, you need to create that little, whether you call it a gimmick or something that's different, that makes you different from the competitors in your market. Would you agree?
Yeah, well, and then taking that, I agree completely. And that's very much why Cookie Time back in 1983 was a success. And then if we forward the conversation to one of our more recent initiatives, where we entered the Japanese market, what we're doing in Japan now is that we're importing number one iconic Kiwi products, which includes our own, of course, and that's where we started 9 years ago. But we've now got other Kiwi products either in the market or in the pipeline to market, and we're applying exactly the same formula. And in Japan, it's probably the situation, but on steroids, because they have very set ways and traditional views, and this is what they do. But they do want something new and different, but they don't want it to be too different. So what we're screening in New Zealand is products that we think are just a little bit innovation, just enough innovation to resonate with the market. So that same kind of idea of not being two steps removed from where the market is, but definitely being one step removed, I think is a principle. Yeah, it's got to be, it can't be boring and the same, copy and paste, that's not going to work. And if you're too soon to market or too advanced in your thinking, you're going to fail also. So it's finding the sweet spot between those two extremes.
And taste. You're finding the taste, because taste profiles around countries can be very, very different. And, you know, our cookie can even be too sweet. So, you know, how do you change that? Or the certain flavors that certain cultures just do not like. Whereas we thought licorice would be a really great innovation in Japan because we love licorice. Oh my goodness, that was not a good idea. The Japanese people on the whole do not like the taste of licorice. So we learned a valuable lesson there.
That's a great point. Like one of the funniest things was like I got married. My first wife was Hawaiian, so we got married in Hawaii. And one of the things I always looked at over there that I found was an interesting innovation that they hadn't done is sushi that had chicken in it or beef. That's only New Zealand. As New Zealand has the biggest form of that. They don't have that in England when I went there. And I have no idea if Japan has it as well, but they don't see it. Like New Zealand's one of the few places in the world that puts katsu chicken into sushi. And like we would never imagine, you'd think that has to be over the world, right? But every time we went to a sushi shop in Hawaii, I was like, can I get chicken sushi? And they're like, no, we don't.
No.
You're an idiot. What are you talking about? Like, really? New Zealand created this? And like, St. Pierre's pretty much invented it around the 80s as well. And it hasn't traveled. But it's amazing the innovations. And it's exactly as you said. It's not completely shifting. It's taking a small step. And I think for the dyslexics out there, when I see entrepreneurs that talk to me about how to be a good entrepreneur, they sometimes jump too far. And, you know, they're creating in their brain. It's so visual. They think they know what's going to happen, but they've gone too far one side without getting actual market feedback.
Well, it's interesting. I would definitely identify with being an entrepreneur. I also identify with being a father, you know, and a husband. But there's only a small number of things I do identify with. But one of them is definitely being an entrepreneur. I believe that's part of my true identity and the way that I get up in the morning and think. And I think that has been very, very helpful as a neurotypical person working in the field of dyslexia and neurodiversity generally. When the neurodiverse individuals, I'm having conversations with them about what's going on for them or one thing or another, a lot of them are entrepreneurial or have entrepreneurial type thinking patterns. And because I think that way as a neurotypical, I think I can identify with the way that they think very easily. There's nothing in the way for me. And I think that's been very, very helpful in being able to work out ways that workplaces can, you know, make it easy for people who are dyslexic, dyspraxic, Asperger's or what have you.
Yeah.
So I think that's helped me in the field that we're playing in, as far as the Dyslexia Foundation.
It's probably helped him that he's married to a dyslexic wife as well.
It certainly helped me understand Suzanne's dyslexia, that's for sure. So, I think the entrepreneurial mind is only one step away from what it is to be neurodiverse, you know. They think differently, and so do entrepreneurs.
I think it takes in that, neurotypical, but as we know, there's nothing that's typical. No one's actually typical, so it's just a name that's given to it. And possibly that entrepreneurial mind is actually more in keeping with the neurodiverse than what it is the neurotypical as such. So I think
if you were to subdivide the neurotypical cohort of people and give them labels, I mean, one would be the entrepreneurial neurotypical and another might be the highly detailed or what have you. But yeah, so I think it's been very, very helpful in terms of understanding. In fact, it's been so profound that I've never really had to think, what do we need to do in the workplace to support people who are neurodiverse? Because to be perfectly honest, they're the people that stand out as being entrepreneurial and think differently. And therefore, that's the way I think as well. So it's never been something that I've actually had to give any serious thought to. And so as the Dyslexia Foundation's agenda has moved into the intersection with the workplace and how to support dyslexic and neurodiverse people in the workplace, I've frankly had to kind of work out what we do that makes our work environment dyslexia and neurodiverse friendly, whereas other businesses struggle with knowing what to do or how to do it or seeing what I see naturally. So that's been a bit of a wake-up call to recognize that what we do naturally as a business, because of the leadership that I've provided in the business, just working at that, it's not typical what we do, but that certainly is something that everybody could learn to do, and there would be massive benefits.
I think it comes down to a lot of what's the environment of cookie time is not hierarchical. So, you know, Guy, for example, being the owner of the business, isn't seen in any different light to as somebody who's working in the bakery. The conversations can be very similar. So it's not a hierarchical system that we have within our business. You know, we all have our different roles that we play, and, you know, different people within those roles of different types of neurodiversity. But I think because we don't run a hierarchical system, it means that actually diversity can be very quickly and easily celebrated within the individuals who work within the business.
That's fantastic. And I think, you know, on that, I think it's beautifully said. And if we fast forward a bit, you know, cookie time for a Kiwi New Zealander, we know how large it's gotten and what a well-known brand it is. But it's gone to a point where you guys are very well known for how you treat your neurodiverse staff. And from that perspective, maybe that's something we could step into, because, you know, myself and a few guys up here in Auckland are looking at creating a thing called the Brain Badge, which is kind of like the rainbow tick, but for neurodiverse businesses. You know, it's a dream. We know it's a long-term project, but we've got 3 or 4 people who are really committed to giving it a crack. And I'd love to hear from you guys. What have you found that is, you know, beyond hierarchical, that's a terrible word, isn't it? beyond that side of things, what could a business which maybe does have a hierarchy, what can they do to support in a larger workplace that their neurodiverse team, do you think?
Yeah, so I think just to unpack that hierarchy, because there's some magic in that. As we know, most businesses and ours does have a hierarchy. Hierarchies are very valuable from an organizational perspective. The difference for Cookie Time is that we have more of a hierarchy of competence, or a culture of competency. Mm-hmm. So this is where your particular competency and what you bring to the table positions you within a conversation. So, you know, if I've got competency in a particular field, then clearly I'm going to be leading that conversation and taking a lead role. But if somebody else has competency, just because I'm the managing director, it doesn't mean that I trump that person in the hierarchy of things. So we do have a hierarchy, but it's more around what you bring to the table, and it's celebrating as a culture of competency, and it's recognizing that everybody has strong competencies and giving them a place and a platform for their voice. So that's kind of like rounds off, I guess, that conversation around hierarchy. I think there's a number of things that we have a culture of inclusion. So this is probably the best story to tell around this idea of inclusion. And that is that a lot of people who are employed by Cookie Time that end up moving on for one reason or another, or employees, existing staff members, or people, suppliers, or people who come in contact with our people, they'll often say to me, I don't know what it is, but there's a real magic. There's a Cookie Time magic. What is it? What's the secret sauce? And everybody within Cookie Time will tell you something different. Somebody will say, oh, it's because I've got flexibility in my role. Oh, it's because I feel like my voice gets heard. It's because they do amazing things at Christmas. Or, oh, it's because of the Cookie Time Charitable Trust and our supportive charities around New Zealand. Everybody has their own reason. But what sits underneath all of those sound bites, and what we don't do, is we don't tell anybody, our staff members or what have you, what it is that we do that's great. We let them discover what they find within the business, which is great. But sitting underneath there, the common denominator is emotional safety. So if you asked me after 38 years to articulate what is the magic of the Cookie Time culture that benefits everybody, including all of our wonderful neurodiverse individuals? It's that we have an environment which has emotional safety at its core. So everything that happens is filtered through emotional safety. And, you know, it's a safe place to be. So if you're at home, you're stressed, maybe you've got some relationship problems or whatever the issues are at home, maybe there's abuse happening at home, whatever it is, okay, big or small, when you come to work, you feel safe. And when you feel safe, you feel comfortable. And when you feel comfortable, you can bring your confident self to the table. You can be more transparent. So it's absolutely central to the whole thing, this idea of emotional safety. And it's not something that we organize, and it's not something that we have a tick box for. It's something that is an absolute non-negotiable. And it's something that my eyes are over the whole time. So the moment you see a particular situation moving into a place of feeling emotionally unsafe, right? Anything like bullying or that would be at a very gross level. But it might even be, for example,
not being heard.
Mm. or a good example would be, there might be people that don't want to attend the barbecue on a Friday. So rather than allowing a memo going out saying, hey, we're looking forward to seeing everybody at the barbecue on Friday, there'll be some, for example, who may be Asperger's who find those social situations very difficult. They need to know that it's okay not to attend. And so the wording would be, if you make it to the barbecue, it'll be great to see you. You know, and so it gives permission for people to play in their safe, emotionally safe zone, because that's where people are going to bring their best to the business.
That's beautifully said, and it's so interesting you bring that up, because the podcast I recorded for this morning, as we're doing this, was around authenticity versus feeling inauthentic. And what I find with a lot of neurodiverse is there is a massive issue with them feeling inauthentic. They're wearing masks. They're hiding who they really are.
Yes.
And it's funny, I literally brought up that feeling of safety is why we're inauthentic, is we don't feel safe to be who we actually are. So with what you're saying makes perfect sense to me. And what a great way to put it is, you know, if you have that lens or that set of glasses, you look at it and go, how can we make everyone feel emotionally safe at work? You know, that's the secret to culture, really, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's more a question of identifying, not working out how to make people safe, but identifying when a particular situation is unsafe. It's a by exception approach, because we've got a business to run. Mm. You know, we need to get up in the morning and make cookies, package cookies, sell cookies, do the accounting for cookies and bars. So we have a business to run, and what we're looking for is anything which provides an unsafe environment and eliminating those. And this is this idea of identifying barriers and removing them. And one of the, so anything that's a barrier to anybody needs to be identified and removed. And everybody can participate in that. But what's the ultimate scenario is where those that actually have more barriers, and neurodiverse individuals, you could argue, have not more barriers, but different barriers, or barriers that are barriers within the workplace as we know it today. We need everybody in the business to identify what their barrier is. And it can be as simple as, I don't want to attend the barbecue on Friday, but I feel that I should. Okay. And just being given permission, well, you don't have to. Mm. And I go, oh my God, that's so great. Thank you. And you know what? Chances are, three times when they've given themselves permission not to attend the barbecue, they might have the courage to, and then they might find they enjoy it, but they might not also. So giving permission for those kind of things, but identifying barriers and removing them is the common theme. And in fact, just this morning, I decided that I was going to step into the Health and Safety Committee, which meets every fortnight at 11 o'clock on a Tuesday. Just found that out this morning. And I'm going to be introducing, as part of our Health and Safety Committee and procedures, the idea of sharing, this idea of people identifying barriers that are personal to them that we can eliminate or remove. And so that's the mantra, which is what we've been doing every day and unconsciously as an organization. But to make it part of the organization, we're going to bring it into the health and safety environment and say this is about emotional safety.
Well, that's good. That's good. That's gold. That is really.
Well, because then what you're doing is you're, and this is an idea which is transferable. We don't actually need this, but I've been thinking about ways that we can take that we do naturally within our business, and how do other businesses, how do they transition into the space? And every business in New Zealand has a regular health and safety meeting with a team of people that crosses the whole business, and that committee could definitely be that committee structure is an ideal structure to do this. And so what will be important is to make sure that there is a representative number of neurodiverse on that committee. That'll be the next step. I'll be saying every meeting, I want you to identify through suggestions or self-identify as a group, barriers that we can remove to make things easier for those that are neurodiverse and all staff, but use the neurodiverse audience within our business as the sharp end of the stick to create the change and the momentum. So that's one initiative.
That is such a good initiative. And I think that's the thing, like when we think of health and safety, we don't think of mental health and emotional safety. That's a game changer, right? Like you always think of physical, but physical is only a small piece of who we are as human beings. And you're quite right. The neurodiverse is nothing. I agree. They don't have more, but they definitely have different barriers, and they're barriers that are less addressed in corporate businesses on average, I guess.
There's nowhere for them to be addressed. That's generally the point. So if you put it under health and safety, then it actually will be addressed because health and safety, the mandate of health and safety is to make sure things are healthy and safe. So, yeah.
It's widening the definition, and it means that we don't need to invent a new structure to deal with this critical issue, which is how to make our workplaces more neurodiverse friendly. And the thing about this is that we can step into what those kind of barriers are and how to remove them further in the conversation. But the key thing for businesses to recognize is that it's actually commercially sensible to be neurodiverse friendly on two fronts. First of all, every business on average has 15% of its workforce or more that are neurodiverse. So if you think it's a problem, well, wake up to the fact that you've already got the problem and you've already employed the problem, okay? Well, rather than seeing it that way, of course, I would say from a business perspective, I would see it as a sunk cost. So we have a sunk cost of 15% of our workforce, which are neurodiverse. Well, the best moves that you can make in business are where you take a sunk cost and you leverage it for the hidden potential. And so there is a massive opportunity to liberate the potential of neurodiverse individuals who are presently working in businesses around the world. And you do that by identifying, by creating emotional safety and identifying and removing barriers. And then the second part of the equation around neurodiversity, and then just widening it even further to anybody with some kind of impairment or difference. And that is that there is a consumer-driven market for people who are neurodiverse. And a good example of that would be if you have got Asperger's and say sensitivity to chaotic environments or high light intensity environments, there are supermarkets now that are providing a 2 or 3 hour shopping window in the evenings where only people that require low light and less people are welcome. And those supermarkets are getting an extra 2 or 3 hours of trading with a very dedicated group of consumers. So it's both, there's a, both a consumer audience opportunity to widen your audience by becoming more neurodiverse friendly as an organization at the consumer facing end. And then there's this massive sunk cost of the neurodiverse that are already employed that you want to liberate. And then And then, of course, there are businesses that actually recognize this already, and a lot in the IT area and entrepreneurial businesses are heavily weighted towards neurodiverse, because it's those kind of people. Weta Workshop's a good example in New Zealand. It's those kind of businesses that require neurodiverse individuals in order to be either in the game or winning in the game that they're in. So that's kind of the landscape that we're looking at. That's how we're viewing it.
I think it's, you know, it makes pure sense. And that's one of the things when I came to the conference you ran that really came across, is that, you know, it from a business point of view, profitability, revenue, it makes sense. These people are already there. A lot of them are there and they haven't been diagnosed, which I think is the, you know, that's the thing we're realizing from the podcast, the amount of 40 plus year old people that are coming out as Asperger's or a high functioning autistic, dyslexic, ADHD, and getting diagnosed when their kids are, is remarkable. It's probably, you know, 15% is probably the low side if everyone actually got diagnosed correctly. And so, you know, these people are in your organization, they're waiting to be heard, and their potential is just being frittered away, you know, if you don't take action. Would you kind of agree with that statement?
Right, certainly. And not only is the organization frittering away the potential, but the individual is living in a constrained worldview and emotionally unliberated. So it is amazing what's happening in the world at the moment. And the time is now for coming out. Well, what I would comment about that is, you know, we view all of these neurodiversities as like the idea of dyslexic type tendencies or Asperger's type tendencies. And I think ultimately we want inclusive environments, and we recognize that a label doesn't define you, because everybody within that label is a little bit different too. All you have to do as an individual, and all a business has to do, is identify what the next barrier is that would be liberating to you, and see whether you and the business together can eliminate it. And it doesn't need to be made any more complicated than that. And so either the business can take the lead by suggesting barriers that they see, or the liberated individual who's willing to say what's going on for them can identify the barrier. It doesn't need to be any bigger than the next thing, the next barrier. And that way we've got the way forward. It's very simple. Mm. You know, I have the need, I'm just speaking now as an example. I have the need to be able to knock on your door and tell you something verbally when it's important to me, rather than sending you an email, okay? And the person that you're telling that to says, I'm more than happy for you to do that. Now that I understand that that's really important to you, feel free to knock on my door and tell me that verbally, right? Rather than sending an email every time, because for the neurotypical, they may want to receive everything in email and longhand because it makes their life easier. But for the dyslexic individual, they want to either
photographs,
they either want to say it, or they want to do it visually.
Absolutely.
Or they want to do it in chunk size bits of information.
Sorry to butt in there, but it's like, I completely agree. And this is in all facets of life for everyone. And to be
exactly,
to create that emotionally safe environment. And like, I'll be like with my partner, Holly, like we were, you know, she was getting frustrated with something that we were doing in the bathroom. We just redone the bathroom, done all the stuff and put in a new towel rack. And she was getting frustrated the way I was hanging my towel up. And we were getting frustrated at each other. We didn't even know why we were getting frustrated at each other until we actually felt safe enough for her to say, actually, I just don't like the way you're hanging it. I know it's a bit OCD a little bit here and there, but this is the way I want you to hang it. And the old way I would have gone is I would have felt really attacked. And instead, like, I felt emotionally safe in our relationship. So I was like, hey, I can make this change for you. And so I've been practicing hanging the towel up the way she wants it hung up. And, you know, I just found when that experience happened, it's kind of like what we're talking about with work, isn't it? It's trying to find those balances where you can both give a little to make a happier environment.
That's the perfect example of, and also exactly that, though, those simple things that you can change in your relationship, as simple as those are, all very transferable into the work environment. And once we recognize that that there's more similarity than difference, then, you know, what we're learning at home, you know, can easily be applied in the workplace.
Sometimes it's just as simple as the way you actually say it. There's different ways of saying things, and you've just got to be very mindful of how you actually are saying something to another person, because it can be misunderstood. And from a simple conversation that somebody doesn't understand, it's really, it can be quite confronting if you haven't actually understood what that person's actually trying to say to you. And, you know, that's the way we use language is incredibly important. Mm-hmm. When I was first working with Cookie Time, we had a cookie bar on the air side in Auckland Airport, and we were visiting. And to visit, you have to go in and get your badge to go through security, blah blah blah. Anyway, we were sitting there. You have your photo taken, and they put your title on your card. And the woman who took our photos, and then she was behind the card. She called out and she said, she's called me up to the counter and she said to me, "I've never come across this title before. What is a creative oversight?" And I said, "I don't know. I've never heard that title before either." So the funny piece there is that Guy had given me a title of creative oversight.
Well, okay, I want to step in here and say this, that first of all, titles are not a big thing in our business. And so Suzanne actually didn't have a title. So when the need for a title arose, I spontaneously came up with this idea of her being a creative oversight. Now, what I meant was that she wasn't an oversight as such, that she oversaw the creative of the business, but lost in translation.
Lost in translation.
So it's been a joke between us ever since.
Because, of course, my dyslexic mind kicked in there and went, oversight. You know, I just saw the oversight piece. So
I think most people would see it that way. Yeah. It was my blunder.
Yeah. So I accepted creative oversight for a short period of time until I became the creative conductor, which actually sat a lot better with how I saw myself within the business.
Yeah, and talking to Suzanne's point about it's the way that you say things and the words and the look and the feel, Suzanne's role in the business, which is absolutely perfect for a dyslexic person, is her formal role is creative conductor. But she's also our aesthetic director, and this means a set of eyes over the whole business that brings a uniformity of aesthetic. So this is, she's watching out for things which step outside of what the brand is meant to be saying, or the brands are meant to be saying, or the business is meant to be saying. And so she's a watchdog over the words that we use, the images that go out to the public, what we say internally and the like. And I think, you know, a good recent example of this where I stepped in was we introduced a no smoking on the property rule just recently. And our general manager did a post to all of our staff just saying that this is a decision that we've made, that we're now a smoke-free site. And it was a very, very well-written post, no criticism whatsoever. And then what I recognized in the post was that it didn't acknowledge how difficult it was for some people to give up smoking. It's very easy when you don't smoke or have never smoked to be able to go, well, we're going smoke free now, so get over it. You need to walk 100 meters in order to have a cigarette out on the road and feel ostracized by the business. So I stepped in there and put a comment to the post, which was along the lines of, I just want to acknowledge how difficult it is for people to give up the habit of smoking, and that we're here to support you, and just built out that that message to that key audience that if you haven't given up smoking yet, it's obviously very difficult. And I personally know how difficult it is because I had to give it up myself when I was 20. But it's just getting that language right and how important that is. That's one of the roles that Suzanne plays, is just keeping an eye. And it's a perfect place for somebody who's dyslexic, who's got a very good visual eye and also is high in empathy. So when she's reading something, she's reading it with her empathetic brain or her heart turned on. And that's very helpful when it comes to creating a consistency across the business.
And I think it's also, you know, that's beautifully said, and it's a great story to illustrate it. And I think when people think of dyslexia, it's such a poor such a poor thought process, right? Like, it's not that we can't read. It's not that we can't even write. You know, I can write a 1,000-word article in 30 minutes. I'm quicker than neurotypical people at writing. It's the grammar's terrible, but it's really flowing. And, you know, what you're saying there is great because of the spatial view of the business. You're looking at it from 1,000 different angles at once and going, do all these angles line up correctly? And I think that's so powerful. And I think it's one of those challenges with dyslexia in business is there's a lot of skill sets that we have that aren't always easily trackable with data. Do you know what I mean by that? Like, I was chatting to a guy I coach in Canberra, and he was saying that's the challenge he has at the moment is he brings a lot to the business and he can see improvements, but it's really hard to quantify the effect he's having on the business directly, but overall he's having a massive impact.
Absolutely. I think another key point I'd want to make around something to recognize with particularly with dyslexic individuals is more often than not they prefer small chunks of information which are visually rich rather than long word-based forms of communication. And the good news is that so many businesses are now transitioning from email, which was really the territory of the neurotypical and the email warriors that are out there, and is transitioning because of the new forms of communication platforms. We use Facebook, it's called Workplace by Facebook, and it basically operates like Facebook in terms of visual posts, GIFs, comments, likes, all of these shorthand ways of exchanging information quickly and rapidly. And it also has a function like Messenger called WorkChat, which is where we have small chunks of information flowing across the business between different groups of people and individuals. In fact, I think on a daily basis, we've got a business with about 150 staff members. We have over 2,000 WorkChats a day going across the business, and we have no internal email now. So we only have external email. And internally, it's all about visual and likes and comments and these small chunks of information via WorkChat. And this plays to the dyslexic person's playbook so well. In fact, when we introduced this platform, it was the neurotypicals that were struggling. How do I find this? Where do I do this? I'm finding this really confusing. And those that were dyslexic were going, oh my God, this is fantastic. I feel so liberated. And, you know, their productivity
increased. And we were showing the neurotypicals what to do and how to do it. Because it was predominantly visual and very responsive. So very quick response, not having to wait for these long bits of information to come through. It's short and it's quick.
Extremely and it's extremely dynamic. And sometimes you wonder how it all holds together because it's not linear. And I would like to say all credit to our neurotypical staff members because they have now adjusted. They've either left the business or adjusted. because this is the new normal. And that was a move away from email and onto Workplace that I had to champion from the top. So I basically introduced it. I said, this is the new normal and you are now not allowed to send emails between each other. You must use this. And if you get an email from the outside, screenshot it and put it into this environment because this is I'm putting the business on a path of no choice. And I think this is the other thing which is helpful for businesses transitioning. You have to have either the leader of the business, you have to have the leader of the business in favor. And ideally you have to have a champion who could be the leader, but could be somebody else who's pushing the neurodiverse friendly practice across the business. And I think if you asked anybody in the business now, neurodiverse or neurotypical, they would say, we love this new way of doing business. It's frighteningly dynamic and incredibly powerful and scary in some respects, but boy, it gets the job done. Get it right for dyslexia, get it right for all. That would be an example of that.
And I love that. I think that's so important. And one of the things I see a lot is people will try stuff like that, but they will only ever dip their toe in and they're waiting for it to fail so they can quickly go backwards.
You're absolutely right.
Like that happens way too often in every business. And I've seen it, you know, I've seen it myself. Like I've moved my desk and there's a part of me that's going, well, just go back to where you were. It's easier. You understand it. It's the devil, you know, it's where you work. Usually, you know, the sounds that are coming in, you know, the lighting, you know, all this stuff. But the other part of me is going, hey, give it 3 or 4 days and it will feel like you've been here forever, and just get through that uncomfortable piece. And that's what you're saying is if you start from the top and you let you know there's going to be uncomfortable challenges, you will get there over time, right?
Yeah, and I think you'll only get through those uncomfortable challenges, which are there for everybody, but particularly and most often with the neurodiverse, you'll only get through those if you are made to feel comfortable in the first instance. So culture and feeling included and feeling that you've got a voice allows you to deal with those more difficult situations. Because I think at the end of the day, as a business owner, we need to organize our resources in a manner that ensures that we make a profit and a return on the investment that the shareholders have made. That is, you know, that's the bottom line. And so we do need a degree of conformity sometimes. But the best way to get to that place, which might not be a place which is as comfortable as everybody wants it to be, is by building comfort and challenging people to do things which are best for the business, but they might find uncomfortable. But you don't get there by forcing that. You get there by building a culture of inclusion and a culture of comfort and micro changes. But there's nothing wrong ultimately with the business wanting to achieve something for the business's sake. And that's when people need to be able to be adaptive. So you're building more flexibility into the business by going down this path, but it starts with empathy and recognizing what changes you can make to make the other person feel comfortable. And then the quid pro quo is that they go out of their way and step into more uncomfortable situations for the benefit of the business. So I think this is, and that's a mature relationship between staff members and the business. And that's where you want to get to. It's not just a one-way traffic. This isn't the last thing I want for people who are neurodiverse is for them to feel victims and feel that they are disabled. I mean, it's the environment which disables them. To get to the end game, there's a process to go through.
Yeah, it's push and pull. It used to be very much push, do this. Now it's you've got to pull people along with you. And what it sounds like, it's the culture you've developed has created that. And it's, I think the important thing for every business owner to listen to this is, or, you know, high up staff member, is that this isn't overnight. There's not one fix that you're going to put in place and then within 24 hours, everything is different. It's a bunch of tiny steps. And going back to what Guy and Suzanne were saying earlier is, you know, it's just identify what's the next barrier to get over one by one. That's the thing,
right? There will be three things that can be done in the next 24 hours. And I urge people to, in this podcast, if you're looking to make change, identify the three things that can happen. Mm-hmm. And that might be ask this person what they need, implement this idea, you know, and do this. But there'll be three very simple things. And if every day you woke up and did three things, it would be you'd see change, you'd see massive change. But the changes are generally very small. The shift from email to chunk size bits of information, for example, is a massive cultural change. That would be a big move. And you know, that's going to take 6 months to embed, and it's going to require somebody just to push it through. So it's identifying, you know, what those bigger moves are and just playing those out one at a time, I would recommend.
And I'd say also that what you'll find with a lot of businesses, and we found this from a listener based in Auckland who's in a big recruitment company, absolutely awesome human being, but she came out as dyslexic, which was amazing. And that's, if you're at the top of an organization, whether it's a support or a top role, if you come out as dyslexic or neurodiverse, that has such a trickle down effect that people don't feel they're alone. And like, you know, I can tell you from the podcast for two or three years now, the amount of emails I get where people just say, I don't feel alone. I'm not the only one, you know, that you cannot ever take away the value of that in an organization.
I think one of the most powerful ideas for leaders within a business, these are people in senior management roles or who own the business. Given that they will know whether they're ADHD or dyslexic or whatever other label, they need to ask their staff to manage them, give them permission to manage up. It's not all about managing down, because you know, somebody who's ADHD but in a leadership role is going to be super powerful. There's no doubt about it, but that person may not cross the I's and dot the T's to the extent that the business needs that to happen. But they'll have staff members under them who can wrap around a great set of meeting notes and follow through with a draft email for the person to send based on the conversation. And that's either effective delegation, or it's the staff members underneath the individual who's got those differences, recognizing that they need to manage up in order to achieve the best outcome, so that we're all in it together, is a really important piece. If you're strongly neurodiverse and you've got those areas that need to be covered off,
yeah.
And that probably comes back for me, the understanding of that word hierarchy, because I probably have a different understanding of the word than what some people do. And for me, I just don't see that within our business. I see that we're able to cross over very effectively from a person who might be more senior than a junior person, and not really seeing the need for differentiation between those two people, because that person will always help that person and that person can help that person. So it's all about actually making the connections, wanting to actually support each other, and having your eyes and ears open so you can see when somebody is not feeling great, or they just need a conversation, or they just want some time on their own. It's being aware of who's in your space and who's around you, no matter where they actually position themselves within the business.
And I think Suzanne's reality there is her reality, in terms of she doesn't see hierarchy in her worldview is not hierarchical. But in fact, a lot of people coming into businesses do value or see hierarchy as important. Not that I believe it is particularly important, it's got its place. A matter of playing those two things.
And that would be that's where the neurodiversity piece comes out, and it's the understanding of different terms within businesses as well. Because sometimes, you know, if you are neurodiverse or dyslexic, and there's terms within businesses that really don't even belong in your universe, it's very difficult to actually understand where somebody else is coming from. So for me, I don't understand when somebody thinks that they have power over somebody else in a situation. I just don't, that's not in my universe.
I'm 100% with you. Like, I don't see class, you know, and I think, you know, coming from a neurodiverse family, like most neurodiverse do, is my mum couldn't see it either. You know, she never taught us a CEO is no better than a cleaner. She couldn't see it. I can't see it.
Yeah.
But again, we have our other challenges where we don't always ask for help, and we try and do everything because we think it, you know, it makes us feel like we can do things. And you'll see, you know, this could be a whole nother podcast, but it's there's a heap of awesome things that can be done. And I think this has been such a beautiful podcast. And I hope a lot of employers do listen to this, or people high up, how they can support their teams. And if I was to ask you guys one last question, what is, you know, if you were to give someone one thing they could do in their organization today or tomorrow, and I know this is a very on the spot one, what is one thing you could consider doing that has made a big impact without too much effort?
Well, would you like to go first?
For me, it would be one thing that I think we do, which I do within the business, which I try to do, is because I'm very visual, I like to give people a representation of what the week has looked like within Cookie Time. So collect visuals of different what's happened in the bakery, what's happened out in grocery, what's happened in the cookie bars, and actually put together a very small photographic collage at the end of, or usually on a Saturday, and share that with our Cookie Time community. So they actually get a visual impact of what we've been doing. So I think visuals are incredibly important within a business. It's not just words, it's the emotion that you can take from seeing an image of what somebody has done within Cookie Time for that week or that year or whatever length of period of time you want to use.
And my comment would be around transparency. I would encourage everybody can be transparent, and the more transparent you are, the better it is for everybody. Yeah. But acknowledging that to be fully transparent is quite a vulnerable place. So it's a journey for individuals. For a business, the aim should be radical transparency. So this is the idea of where everything is transparent to everybody, and everybody can comment and communicate and contribute towards whatever's going on in the business. And the more transparent you can be, it's a superpower of a business. But it does take a culture of comfort and safety in order for that to be. But you can start playing with that idea. Everybody in the business can start to become more transparent. And what they'll find, generally speaking, is that they're going to get feedback about that transparency. Hopefully it's largely positive. Sometimes it won't be, but if it's not, turn that into a positive. But there's a real magic in the journey towards radical transparency in a business.
It's taking the ego out of the business.
I love that. It's funny you say that, because my partner Holly, her mum's business does training on a thing called radical candor, which is around real open talk. It's a book from and training. And they, you know, it seems to be going through a lot of organizations about that radical openness. So they're not shocked halfway down the track that something's happened and they didn't know about it, right? And it helps neurodiverse, it helps everything. So it's a great way to finish. Thank you so much for your time, guys. I appreciate it. And we'll have to keep doing this every little while, because there's been so much value that's come out of it. Hope you've enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Stephen.
Thanks,
guys.